Michael Swear is a book. Art. Media. Life and Swear is about. Art. Life and Swear is about. Culture. Art. Media.
Life and Swear is about. Art. Media. And culture.
Stand by. Quiet in the studio, please. Cue Norman B. Roll intro. Cue theme music. 3, 2, 1.
This is Life Elsewhere, created and hosted by Norman B.
Hello there, welcome to Life Elsewhere. In today's show, we're going to talk about a very serious illness that affects over 1 million people in the US of A, and many more millions worldwide. It's an illness that science doesn't understand. Award-winning science writer Julie Raymeier was so sick she sometimes couldn't turn over in bed. The top specialists in the world were powerless to help, and scientific research on her disease was at a near standstill. She was running out of money, and she was all alone, with no one to care for her. This is the beginning of the story she tells in her new powerful and emotive memoir, Through the Shadowlands. Now, don't you go anywhere. I don't want you to miss my interview with Julie Raymeier. First, as you get yourself comfortable, perhaps spread yourself out or languidly on a velvet sofa, while we hear a lovely example of new music from South London, it's an outfit called Sunken with Swoon. This is Life Elsewhere.
Don't go.
That was Swoon by Sunken from South London. Brand new music right here on Life Elsewhere. Now, if you want to hear more new releases, make sure you check out my other show, Life Elsewhere Music, and you can find it on Mixcloud and over at lifeelsewhere.co, that's C-O. And just go to the music page. Coming up, an interview I do not want you to miss. You're about to learn so much from my guest. You'll be moved and you'll be surprised. Julie Raymeyer is next, right after this.
This is Life Elsewhere, hosted by Norman B. Let us know what you think of our show. Send your comments to info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O.
Through the Shadowlands, a science writer's odyssey into an illness science doesn't understand. Now, when my producer put this down on my desk and said, you got to read this, I have to be honest, I glanced at the cover and I glanced at the title, and then I sort of quickly did a quick check and I saw it was by a science writer, and I thought it said, and this is me being silly, and I thought, oh gosh, it's just another science fiction book. How wrong could I be? The author is Julie Raymeyer. Julie, welcome to Life Elsewhere.
Oh, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So your book, gosh, I'm not even sure I have enough words to describe the sort of the emotions that I felt reading it and then how I felt afterwards. I'm so sorry that I first of all sort of almost dismissed it as being, and not that there's anything wrong with science fiction, of course, but I get sent a lot of books, and sometimes they're science fiction, and they sort of go off into sort of fantasy. And when I sort of saw the synopsis of this book, I forgive me, but it did seem to me like this was a bit of a fantasy. Has that come up before with you?
Only in the sense that the experiences I had that I describe in the book had, for me, this kind of mythical quality.
Yes.
Where I almost felt like I was like living a novel,
yes.
You know, living a fantasy or a science fiction novel. Like the experiences were so, struck me as so unlikely, and everything had, it felt so significant. I mean,
yes.
Just one example of that is one of the key events in the book. I was terribly ill. I had run out of medical options, and I was often too sick to turn over in bed and really in a terrible state. And I ended up deciding to pursue a theory that I pretty much thought was crackpot, but I didn't have any better ideas. And the theory was that mold was what was making me sick. And the advice I was given was to go to Death Valley for 2 weeks with none of my own belongings to get clear of mold. And then I was told that when I went home, if mold was indeed my problem, I would react very clearly and strongly to my own stuff and where I was living. And so I'm driving off to Death Valley to do this, which, you know, in and of itself is kind of this amazing thing, you know, this kind of quest into the desert that did have this very mythical quality. And the particular desert I'm going to is Death Valley.
Yes, yes.
And it felt so, you know, the metaphors were almost too crude.
Yes, yes. Let's, before we go any further, let's just, because I know we've sort of set this up, so my listeners are now sitting on the edge of their chairs trying to figure out exactly what we're talking about. You suffered from chronic fatigue syndrome. And you didn't.
That's right.
You did not know what this was. And I want to, if you don't not mind, I want to just read a little piece from your book right at the very beginning, because this sort of sets up everything. You were feeling tired. You were feeling like you had no energy, and you just didn't know what was wrong. So you go to see a neurologist, and I'm going to read this, and we're going to have to censor just a little bit. But here we go. The doctor proclaimed, your strength is within the normal range. There's nothing neurologically wrong with you. And you say, I couldn't make sense of what I was hearing. This was obviously impossible. You have chronic fatigue syndrome, he said. Fatigue, I thought. Sure, I've been tired for years, and I wondered if chronic fatigue syndrome might explain it. But this wasn't fatigue. I couldn't fucking walk. And wait, the neurologist hadn't even done any fancy tests. He'd only pushed on my legs. I struggled to speak. I knew what I wanted to ask, but the words scampered away from me like a flurry of mice. I finally mumbled something about further testing. Well, yes, I could order an MRI or maybe an electromyogram, he said. But I already knew the results would be normal. Oh my gosh, I'm just thinking about being in a neurologist's office and being faced with that. And then a little bit later on, you Google, and I want to talk about that because there's a really important part, Julie, where you say that you Google chronic fatigue syndrome and you came across a 1990 Newsweek cover article calling the illness yuppie flu. I remember that when yuppie flu was the sort of the byline or the headline in some cases. Can you talk about that?
Yes, absolutely. So there's the name chronic fatigue syndrome is so unfortunate because it sets up this idea that's almost impossible to get rid of, that the illness is about being tired. And certainly fatigue is an aspect of the illness, but it's not actually, it is not an illness of being really tired. In fact, the central, the hallmark symptom of chronic fatigue syndrome isn't fatigue at all. It is exercise intolerance. So when you exercise, it makes you much, much worse if you have chronic fatigue syndrome. The next day, you will feel absolutely terrible. That is the thing that kind of should perk up a doctor's ears, that chronic fatigue syndrome is what's going on. You know, if you just say, I've been really tired, that could be all kinds of things. But there's an enormous amount of ignorance about the disease, kind of on all levels. And the name plays a very significant role in that, I think. That neurologist diagnosed me, for example, he didn't even ask me if I had exercise intolerance. I don't know if he even knew that that was an aspect of the disease. He just knew, I mean, I came into his office and I could literally barely walk. And the problem wasn't so much fatigue. It wasn't that I didn't have the energy to move my legs. It felt as though the nerve signals were not quite making it all the way from my brain down to my legs. And I staggered, and it was such incredibly hard work to walk. You know, I groaned with every step, and just the absolute limit of what I could do to move my legs at all. So, you know, he looked at it, and it wasn't something he was familiar with, and chronic fatigue syndrome for him was just this kind of wastebasket to throw me in to say, hey, it's not my problem. And it's really unfortunate.
Now, this is, I think, what I got from your book is that this is such an important part of your book, that the medical practices, medicine and science doesn't seem to have really focused in on this like you would like it. And you really go into great depth in your book. I want to talk to you about the fact that you discovered that mold, because this seems so, this is where it does go into this area that I thought maybe it was science fiction, this whole idea of mold. And mold is everywhere, isn't it? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, mold is everywhere. But not all kinds of molds cause me problems. And actually, I should also say, I use mold as kind of a stand-in word, because when a building gets wet, gets damaged by water, mold grows, and that causes the release of all kinds of stuff into the indoor air. So you've got little bits of the mold itself, you've got spores the mold releases, you've got toxins the mold releases, you've also got bacteria, you've got toxins the bacteria release, you've got volatile organic compounds, you've got particulates. It's this whole stew of stuff in the air in a water-damaged building. And something in that stew of stuff does me in. But there hasn't been the scientific research to know what exactly it is, or if it's a combination of things. You know, that's just not clear. So it's not that any type of mold is dangerous to me, thank goodness, since, as you say, mold is everywhere. But there's clearly something that's associated with water-damaged buildings that my body cannot tolerate. We just haven't done the research to figure that out.
Julie Raymeyer is my guest. Her book is called Through the Shadowlands. The book reads, in parts it reads just like a, I mean, it's like, it reads like fiction. I have to be honest with you. It in parts, I'm almost sort of just thinking to myself, is she, because I want to get into talking about just some of the backgrounds, some of your background, about your mother and about, I thought just a moment ago I could hear, because it sounds like I can hear birds tweeting in the background, and it sounds like I could hear your dog, Francis. Is that right?
No, Francis isn't here right now, but you did hear birds tweeting in the background.
Okay, all right. I want to talk about Francis because she plays a really important part in the story.
She is a star.
She's a star, yes.
She's all right, star of the book.
Let's talk about Francis right now. Let's talk about her.
Yeah, so several years into my illness, before I was really dreadfully sick, but, you know, sick enough to be a problem, I got a little puppy, a little brown mutt puppy. She's grew to be about 40 pounds, a little hound mix. And she just brought me tremendous joy. And during the time when, you know, I was bedbound half the time, sometimes too weak to turn over in bed, she was such a source of just joy and comfort. You know, she spent hours curled up in a ball next to me, and her life force felt like it was a real resource for me. And then I had this idea during the time when I was really terribly ill that I could train her as a service dog for myself.
Ah.
And my image was, one of the problems that I had, my state varied quite a lot. So when I was doing well, I could go out and you know, do some things, run some errands, that kind of thing. But I could at any moment literally get paralyzed and be unable to move, like unable to get back to my car. And so I had this image that I would train her to pull me. And the kind of full image was that I would get a scooter, so basically like a skateboard with a folding handle and a brake.
Ah, yes.
And that I could stand on the scooter and she could pull me to safety. And I loved this image. I mean, it was ludicrous, but also clever, and it just felt like me. And so, I found resources online that showed me how to train her as a service dog, and I started working on this during the time that I was very ill, and it was a fantastic project in so many ways. It was something that I could do from bed.
Yes.
It was something I could, you know, I could train her in public when I was well enough, and I could train her in bed when I was not well enough. And when I was really not well, it could just pause and that wasn't a problem. And it was such a fascinating project that it kind of helped my brain work a little better. One of the symptoms of chronic fatigue syndrome is that it causes cognitive problems. So, you know, there were many times when I just couldn't really think. But my fascination with that project helped my brain work better. So she really pulled me through. And when I figured out the connection with mold, I thought about training her to detect mold, because there are, in fact, dogs that do that. Ultimately, I decided the practical difficulties were too great. In particular, it would require her to be able to smell the bad molds, which would require me to be in close proximity to the bad molds, and that seemed excessively dangerous. Francis is a central figure in the book.
Yes, yes, and you tell the story so incredibly well.
Thank you.
What an amazing story this is. And I'm just, as you're talking about Francis, and you're talking about laying in bed, and you can barely move, all kinds of thoughts initially went through your mind. You started to think about all the different things that you could have. Can you talk about that? Because I think this is so important, and it's almost difficult to read, because I'm imagining myself thinking to myself, laying there, wondering about what really do I have. Can you talk about that, Julie?
Absolutely. Yeah, it was a real challenge. You know, I was at this place where I'd pretty much run out of medical options. I was living by myself. I was really too sick to reliably take care of myself. I didn't have family to turn to. I was running out of money. It was a really dire situation. But there I was, and I had to find some way of living with this. And I quickly realized there was not very much I could do at that moment on a practical outward level. And so pretty much my choices were to worry or not to worry.
Yeah.
And when, you know, when you put it to yourself that way, well, it becomes fairly clear, you know, worry isn't going to accomplish much. And so I decided not to worry. And instead, I focused in a very immediate way on the pleasures available to me at that moment. And Francis, of course, was one great source of that pleasure. Also just things like I was living in a pair of travel trailers on my land, and my land is very beautiful. It's outside Santa Fe. There's a stream going through it. And just lying in bed, having the door open so that I could look out toward the stream and hear the stream babbling and see the birds hopping around and watch Francis playing with a stick. And I discovered that those tiny sources of pleasure could actually be really quite big. And I also felt it was not just that it made that time less miserable, though it certainly did, but I also felt like that process of really tuning in and staying calm, not letting all of my energy go into worry, was an important aspect of figuring out how to get better.
Yes.
You know, it on multiple levels. One is not having a whole lot of energy going into worry means the energy can go somewhere better. And so, you know, I was able to, when I was capable, to think about, you know, possibilities of what to do and that kind of thing in a more constructive way. It also connected, though, with a pretty deep sense of spirituality for me that felt really important for finding a way forward. You know, I grew up, my mother was a Christian Scientist.
Yes.
And I'm not a Christian Scientist, but her beliefs influenced me in a big way. And in particular, the core of Christian Science for her was that the true form of reality is spiritual rather than physical.
Right.
And that by working on that spiritual level, by paying attention to our own thoughts and feelings and beliefs, that's actually a very powerful way of influencing the outside world. In fact, in her beliefs, the very most powerful way of influencing the outside world. So for me at that time, that process of occupying the moment that I was in, occupying the experience that I was in, and seeing it as much as it wasn't what I would choose, seeing it as an experience worth having, gave me the confidence that even though I couldn't see a path forward, that I would manage to find my way there.
Julie Raymeyer is my guest. The book is called Through the Shadowlands, a science writer's odyssey into an illness science doesn't understand. There's a lot more questions I have for you, and one that centers around you being a science writer and how you, and I guess this is just the simplest way to say it, how you thought about what was happening to you, because you writing science means you have an analytical brain, I would think. So I want to talk about that in a little bit of detail.
Right.
And we're going to do that right after this.
Thank you for listening to Life Elsewhere, hosted by Norman B. To learn more about our program, our guest, and the music we feature, go to lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Julie Raymeyer. She has written a memoir. This is a book that I highly encourage you to read. It's called Through the Shadowlands, a science writer's odyssey into an illness science doesn't understand. Now, Julie, you were, and still are, a science writer. You write about science. So you have an analytical mind, I'm thinking. You think things through.
That's right.
So when you're confronted with this, I'm wondering, because in your book, you tell it in great detail, but I'm wondering if you can tell my listeners, when the sort of the realization came to you that this was something before the doctor, and even when the doctor, the neurologist, said you had chronic fatigue syndrome, when did it really sink into you that you had chronic fatigue syndrome?
It took a long time. When the neurologist diagnosed me with chronic fatigue syndrome, I was not at all sure that meant anything.
Yeah.
And in fact, I think out of his mouth, it didn't really mean much. I mean, for him, it seemed to mean, get out of my office. I have nothing to offer you.
Yes.
Of course, that is not a terribly compelling diagnosis. And so there was a process for me. I consulted other doctors, and initially, you know, I assumed there was some other diagnosis and I would find it. As I talked to more doctors and did not find another diagnosis, then I kind of accepted chronic fatigue syndrome by default. But it was still quite a while before I was really convinced that it meant anything much to say that. The thing that made it seem like, okay, this is an actual illness that I have.
Yeah.
Was learning more about the science. And an important aunt who's a chronic fatigue syndrome specialist in Florida, and she is an immunologist, and she explained to me how she had been a doctor in the 80s studying AIDS, and she had these other patients come to her who were fatigued, had trouble with exercise, and they were convinced that something was wrong with their immune systems. And she didn't really think she had anything to offer, but to placate them, she tested their immune systems, and she found a characteristic pattern of immune abnormalities in these patients. That finding out about physiological abnormalities that are fairly consistent across patients, that was the thing that really made me think, okay, this is an actual illness. Now, it may be that the causes are different for different patients, so there may be significantly different subgroups that need different kinds of treatments. But nevertheless, I'm now convinced that there's a fundamental physiological problem that these patients share, and that makes saying that a patient has chronic fatigue syndrome mean something. And one more thing to add is I actually typically don't use the name chronic fatigue syndrome because it's so dreadful. Internationally, the more common name is myalgic encephalomyelitis, which is quite a mouthful.
Yeah, that's easy for you to say.
Yeah, right. Federal agencies in the U.S. have started calling it MECFS for myalgic encephalomyelitis / chronic fatigue syndrome, and that's the term that I typically use.
Now, throughout the book, there's something that caught my attention, and that is you use Google a great deal. You go online. You research things. I'm curious to know about that, because I think all of us in this day and age, we all use Google for almost everything. We just go online to search something out. But I was thinking about this as I'm reading your book, Julie, and I'm thinking, what would have happened if this had been 5 years earlier, 10 years earlier? And I'm wondering if you thought about that, about how much just going online helped you.
Absolutely. I don't know what I would have done if I hadn't had the internet to turn to. I don't think I would have found the answer. Even hearing about it, it was such a stretch for me to explore it and seemed so unlikely. And I can't imagine how I would have figured it out on my own. And it's pretty amazing, actually, how the internet is changing things, because it does give us the ability to do our own research and to find information that often is more reliable than our doctors. Of course, at the same time, you have to be very careful about what you read online, because it's a mixture of all kinds of stuff, and some of it is just junk.
Yes.
So you have to be very discriminating in judging what you read. But nevertheless, it does give you the power, if you do the research and you're sufficiently discerning about it, to become an absolute world expert in your own issues. And in the case of an illness like ME/CFS or any other, I think, poorly understood illness, really the leading experts do end up being patients. And so having the opportunity to learn from them is just completely invaluable. And that was a real eye-opener for me, because initially I was pretty skeptical of my fellow patients. You know,
yeah.
Part of that, I think, was that I had absorbed the kind of societal prejudice about the illness. Another aspect of it is when I went on to an online patient forum and started reading, these patients were frighteningly ill, and I did not want to be frighteningly ill.
Yes, yes.
And you know, I mean, I now feel ashamed of this, but I think part of my response to that was to say, I'm not like them. Those people are, you know, they're not doing scientific treatments. They're not in some way as good as I am, and that means I won't get that sick.
Yes.
And of course, then I did get that sick, and I got over it. You know, I realized, I guess I shouldn't sneer at these people since I'm one of these
people.
You're
one of them, yes.
Then going into those forums and reading it with an open mind and an open heart, I discovered that some of these patients are the most thoughtful, intelligent, many of them with deep scientific training. There's just a well of knowledge and intelligence and resources in the patient community that is phenomenal.
You know, there's something you touched on just a little bit ago that you said about when we were talking about going online, using the internet, and you said about sometimes there's misinformation and you can't trust everything you read. And I wanted just to focus in on something which caught another thing that caught my attention. This is right at the very back of your book. It's a notes on accuracy. And I love this because you're very honest about this. Can you just very briefly talk about just what you write about a note on accuracy?
Oh, you bet. Yeah. So, you know, I'm writing a memoir and I'm a journalist, and my training is to be rigorously accurate. Of course, in the process of writing a memoir, you're creating scenes. And so I really, really worked to make things absolutely as factual as I could. But I also recognized that there were some limitations to that because of the fact that I was writing, you know, full scenes. So, for example, the example I give in that note, the beginning of the book describes when I'm building my house. I built a straw bale house myself, and it was during that period that I first started getting sick. And I tell a little story about how at the end of the day, of the particular day I'm describing, I had two round brown marks on my chest where I had leaned up against a freshly plastered wall. And so as I wrote that scene, I had this kind of moment of hesitation, because while I very often did have those round brown marks on my chest at the end of a day of plastering, I couldn't absolutely swear that particular day I was talking about I did. So I wanted to acknowledge that there were those kinds of uncertainties in my account. And at the same time, I really, really worked hard to make sure that everything was as factual as I could make it. There were no composite characters. I didn't move the timeline around. I didn't, you know, make anything up. And I also wanted to be totally honest with my readers about exactly what my standard was and where I was drawing those lines.
Yes. Well, this now leads us into talking about a character in your book, which I think my listeners are going to find very fascinating, and this is Eric the Mold Warrior. We're going to talk about Eric the Mold Warrior right after this.
You're listening to the best show on radio about art, media, and culture. Life Elsewhere with Norman B.
My guest is Julie Raymeyer. Her book is called Through the Shadowlands, a science writer's odyssey into an illness science doesn't understand. Generally known as chronic fatigue syndrome, now known as, and I hope I've got this right, Julie, MECFS, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Okay, I'm going to try. Good memory there. So, in this fascinating book of yours, in this memoir, you come across a number of interesting characters. We've talked about your dog, Francis. And I just wanted to touch on something that you mentioned earlier, just a few minutes ago, and that was about when you were building your house in Chapter 1. There's a great line, and you're talking about putting the straw and the mud together, and I don't know, this caught me. It was grab mush, grab mush, grab mush. I just love that. It's very, very descriptive. So Eric, let's talk about Eric, the mold warrior.
Yes, Eric is quite a guy. So I heard about this mold hypothesis, and it was originally, the connection between mold and chronic fatigue syndrome was originally figured out by this guy, Eric Johnson. And I read some of his writings, and I was a little put off. He seemed kind of pretty extreme and just not somebody that I was particularly comfortable with. But I was talking to other patients who I did feel more comfortable with, and I decided to pursue this, and I went and spent 2 weeks in Death Valley with none of my own belongings as a way of testing whether mold was in fact a problem for me. And the prediction was that after those 2 weeks, that when I was exposed to mold again, I would react really clearly and strongly, and then I would know that mold was in fact what was making me sick, and by avoiding it, I would get better. So at the end of my 2 weeks, I thought, okay, I want to do everything I can to give this probably ridiculous theory a chance. And so I decided to drive up to Reno to meet Eric the Mold Warrior. And we got together for lunch and had a conversation. And Eric went on and on about how none of the researchers had listened to him. He had figured this out. This was the answer for millions of people, but nobody would listen to him. And he had gone to such extremes. He had even stalked these researchers, and they still wouldn't listen to him. Can you believe it? He asked me over and over. And I thought, somehow, I can believe it. And if I weren't so desperate, I wouldn't be listening to you either. And so after lunch, he took me to a Whole Foods that he told me was moldy. And this was going to be the first real test of this hypothesis for me. So we walked around the Whole Foods and stops at some point, and he says, oh yeah, it's here. And I thought, am I in a poltergeist movie?
Right.
And I felt nothing. I felt absolutely nothing. And so I went back to my hotel, and we were gonna do another expedition the next day, but I felt so disappointed, so ashamed that I had taken this guy seriously, so angry. And I stomped around the hotel room for hours trying to calm down. And then I went to bed. Finally, it was late enough that I could just go to sleep. And I woke up in the middle of the night, and I felt awful. I felt poisoned in a way that was really unfamiliar, like every cell in my body wanted to throw up, and I couldn't walk. I staggered to the bathroom. And then the most amazing thing was I took a shower, which I had been told would help, had never made a difference in the past, and I stepped out of the shower feeling nearly well. It was just completely incredible. Yes. So I'm sitting there in bed afterward and send an email to the friends who are following along with this saga saying, woohoo, I can't walk.
Yeah. You know, can I just say this? In reading your book and then just now listening to you as well, it came across in your memoir that you have gone through, you've experienced the range of emotions that possibly I think we all as human beings go through emotions, but you seem to have gone through so much in such an extraordinary way, and you put it across in your book, and you put it across in just talking to you. I have to just touch on something which I'd like to share with my listeners. And let me just remind everybody, we're talking to Julie Raymeyer. Her book is called Through the Shadowlands. In the contents of your book, the chapter headings, and I just want to read out a few of the chapter headings, because I think this really gives an idea of just how daunting this book does seem. Chapter 2, Crippled. Chapter 3, Doctors. Chapter 5, The Great Collapse. Chapter 6, The Miracle. Chapter 7, Alone. Chapter 8, Rage. then Chapter 12, Death Valley. Chapter 13, The Mold Tour. Oh gosh, and then it goes on. Let me see. Chapter 18, The Devil Disease. Chapter 19, Moldy Science. Wonderful stuff. It really is. Let's just talk for a moment about chronic fatigue syndrome as it pertains today, which is now we know as MECFS. I'm not even going to try to pronounce all those words, but we'll just stay with that. Lots of people suffer from this syndrome, but are some still misdiagnosed? Is it still? It does seem from your book, and this is what you're saying, is that science is still not up to par.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. Things are starting to change, and it's very exciting. It's a really different world from, say, 6 years ago. There's now the NIH, National Institutes of Health, have finally gotten interested in the disease, and they're doing a study themselves, and they're starting to increase funding for other researchers. We've got a long way to go with that, but we're at least finally moving the right direction. There are also some really top-notch researchers who have gotten interested in the disease. And so at this point, I feel optimistic that we're going to start getting some answers, you know, within the next, say, 5 to 10 years, that we'll know some significant things that we don't know now. But right now, we still know very, very little about what fundamentally is going on in this disease.
You know, something that's another question that came to my mind as I'm reading your book is, I sort of thinking in terms, well, this is an American disease, but it's not, is it? Can you talk about...
Yeah, in fact, so a million Americans are estimated to be affected by the disease, and 30 million people around the world. So it is definitely not an American disease. It's also not a first world disease. You know, people often think the old thing about yuppie flu, that this is just rich white women who are affected by it. That's not true at all. In fact, it's worse in poor among poor people, which, you know, isn't really surprising because most health problems are worse among poor people. There was also a study done in Nigeria looking at rates of chronic fatigue syndrome in Nigeria, and it was just as prevalent there as in the first world.
Here's a question for you, and I don't know if you can answer this just as simply as I'm going to put it, but in reading your book, I'm wondering what you consider to be the worst of times and what you consider to be the best.
That's an interesting question. I mean, for me, I think the times that are the most difficult are when I don't feel like I understand what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, that sense of being totally at sea, that's really challenging for me to deal with. And I describe in the book, I mean, of course, I had a fair amount of that.
Yes, exactly.
Over the course of this film.
Yeah.
And I describe in the book the way that I learned to deal with that so that it didn't just tear me to pieces. But it's still fundamentally a challenging thing. You know, I like feeling grounded and like I've got a plan and can go do it. In terms of the best of times, the immediate thing that comes to my mind is the story I tell in the book about meeting my husband and the relationship that we formed. And I 3 months after I got back from Death Valley, I met the man that I ended up marrying. And it was such an extraordinarily different relationship than I'd ever had before. And that was very much influenced by the experiences that I'd had with my illness. In particular, before I got so terribly ill, I, like most people, had, you know, dreams and expectations for my life and was working very hard to make them all happen. And some of those dreams involved, you know, having a man in my life, looking for the man to fill the bill. And when I got so terribly sick, then those dreams and expectations started seeming just ridiculous and absurd and like way too much to demand of myself, like way too weighty. And there was this incredible kind of transformation that occurred for me where I was able to let all of those things go and just breathing, you know, just being alive felt like this incredible gift. And I had this experience in Death Valley. I really felt as though I went to the desert to die. Like the trajectory that I was on over the course of my life just ended there.
Yes.
And so there was this incredible kind of expansiveness. Like I was gifted with this sort of second life that was entirely sort of unearned and that I had no particular responsibilities in. And that experience put me in a completely different place with respect to a relationship, because at that point, rather than looking for a man to fill the bill and help me realize my dreams, I had a place of like, hey, being alive is pretty amazing. You want to share it with me?
Yes.
And so there was a sort of expansion for both of us that really allowed us both to kind of be fully who we were, who we are, and to allow the relationship to go in any direction that it wants to go in. And it's been an incredible, I like every day I feel so grateful to have John in my life. It's just this unbelievable blessing.
Well, can I say this to you, having read your book Through the Shadowlands, and I should let my listeners know that the very first part, when you go into the desert, it is just, oh my gosh, it's just, it had me on the edge of my seat. I couldn't put the book down because it really was just so harrowing. But then the big takeaway from your book, and you've just touched on it, and my listeners who listen regularly to this program know that I sort of focus on this quite a bit. You gave hope. You gave me hope. And it seemed to me that sort of like the underlying message about a relationship and about just life in general, the optimism that you now have, you didn't give up, you went forward, and then finding John, you put this across so well. But as I said, the takeaway to me is there's hope. There's always hope. Gosh, I love that so much.
Right.
The book is called Through the Shadowlands, A Science Writer's Odyssey into an Illness Science Doesn't Understand. I want to very quickly, I'm going to take a quick break, and I very quickly just want to ask you about what's going on now, because it just seems to me, as you said, there's millions of people across the world, a million in the United States. What's happening now? And what happens if somebody thinks that they have MECFS? We'll do that right after this.
You're listening to My Dad, Norman B. in Life Elsewhere.
Okay, this time, try it a little faster.
You're listening to My Dad and Norman B. in Life Elsewhere.
My guest is Julie Raymeyer. Her book is a must-read, Through the Shadowlands. It's a memoir, a science writer's odyssey into an illness science doesn't understand. Now, you said there's a million people in the United States with chronic fatigue syndrome, now known as MECFS, and across the world, there's many more million. So if somebody is suffering from this syndrome, what's your advice? What should they do?
Yeah, so I mean, the first thing I'd say is that you should figure out if you really do have MECFS, because as I said earlier, just being really tired does not mean you have MECFS. And the hallmark symptom of it is that exercise makes you worse. So if that is not the case for you, something else is going on and you should figure out what else is going on. If you really do have any CFS, and I should say that's not enough. There are some other symptoms that are required too, but the exercise intolerance is really key. So if you do have ME/CFS, there are a variety of things I think you should do. The very first thing, the very first and most important thing is you need to learn to not overdo it. Because of exercise intolerance, if you push yourself, it makes you worse. And that's both, it makes you worse in the short term, but also in the early stages of the illness, I think that overdoing it makes it much more likely that the illness will progress as a whole. So if you can give yourself the rest that you need, you've got a much more chance of, much greater chance of your body being able to heal from it on its own. Mm-hmm. So that is really, really key. It's important to get good medical care, partly because there can be other problems going on as well. But the fact is that very few doctors have much to offer on this illness. So unless you're lucky or determined enough to find one of the doctors who actually really knows something about it, you're not likely to get all that much help in that direction. However, there's an enormous amount of wisdom in the patient community, and I would really encourage patients to tap into that. There's a forum called the Phoenix Rising Forum that has a great wealth of information. There are Facebook groups that are very helpful, all kinds of online information. And I guess the final thing that I would say is, of course, mold has not been studied very much. We don't know how big a factor it is in the disease. It was very big in my case, but that is not necessarily the case for everyone with chronic fatigue syndrome. However, I do think that it's worth considering. I mean, if you're dealing with chronic fatigue syndrome and you're definitely living in a moldy house, there's a pretty good chance that's making you worse. Yeah. And addressing that could make a real difference.
Just very quickly before we go, just going back to misdiagnosis once again, because I think I've got to ask you this about depression, obviously the syndrome itself would cause depression, but what about having depression that causes an illness?
Right. So, and this has been a source of enormous, enormous confusion. Of course, one of the major symptoms of depression is that people are exhausted.
Yeah.
So if you think of chronic fatigue syndrome as just chronic fatigue, being tired all the time, then many depressed people have it. But what depression doesn't cause is the exercise intolerance. With people who are just dealing with depression, then exercise makes them feel better.
Yes.
People with chronic fatigue syndrome, exercise doesn't make them feel better. Of course, you can have ME/CFS and also have depression. I mean, that's not so uncommon. Having a really terrible and poorly understood and maligned disease is a really big bummer, right? So it's not surprising that patients sometimes get depressed. But that's a separate issue from the disease itself.
Mm. So well put. And what a great read. Through the Shadowlands, a science writer's odyssey into an illness science doesn't understand. Julie Raymeyer has been my guest. Julie, it's been delightful talking with you. Thank you so very much for joining us. Thank you so much for joining us. Julie, that was absolutely terrific. Wonderful. You're a great guest. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was really a pleasure. And you're a wonderful reader, by the way. I love the way you read that passage.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I learned an incredible amount from Julie, and you know that's what Life Elsewhere is all about. I choose the subjects and authors and music because they interest me, and I want to share my discoveries with you. I've been producing Life Elsewhere, in this form, for a few years now, and coming up, we've got some major developments in the works, which means I'm going to be traveling soon, so we're going to be presenting a few archive editions of the show, which leads me to ask you to help me out. What would you like to hear again? Let me know about an interview or a subject that you liked. Send your ideas and your thoughts and questions, perhaps, to normanb@lifeelsewhere.co. Now, with just a few minutes left in this edition, here's a piece of music that I think works perfectly for today's guest, Julie Raymeyer. Another one from London. This is Chloe Leone with a tasty number. It's called Comfortably Me. Comfortably Me by Chloe Leone, a new release, and we're going to dedicate that one to our guest today, Julie Raymeyer. I'm Norman B, and I thank you so much for listening. Till next time, be good, be well, and always, it costs you absolutely nothing, be nice.
You have been listening to Life Elsewhere, created and hosted by Norman B. Life Elsewhere is written and produced by Norman B. Guest booking and additional research by Stephanie Lane. Behind the scenes assistance by James Van, Bruce Goodman, and Allison Klein. We love to hear what you think about Life Elsewhere. Send your questions, queries, and comments to info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O. Life Elsewhere is produced at the studios of WMNF Tampa.